we put a huge amount of effort into a kind of emotional avoidance, right? We think what we want to do, we may tell ourselves that what we want to do is live accomplished lives and do meaningful things and help people. But a lot of the time, what we want to do is kind of not feel the anxiety and stress that comes from acknowledging our limits and our finite nature.
All right, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, and by trade and training, I am a sport and performance psychologist. And the whole idea behind this podcast, behind these conversations, is to learn, is to pull back the curtain from some of the most extraordinary thinkers and doers across the planet to better understand how they have committed to mastering both their craft and their minds. And the whole effort underneath of it is to become their very best so that they can help others become their very best. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing, it just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product, and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's Hims, HIMS.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. Hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Now, this week's conversation is with Oliver Berkman, a British author and journalist who I've really enjoyed his writings on productivity, mortality, the power of limits, and thoughts on building a meaningful life in an age of distraction. So Oliver is the winner of the Foreign Press Association's Young Journalist of the Year Award, and for many years wrote a hit weekly column for The Guardian called This Column Will Change Your Life. And in this conversation, we dive into his newest book, 4,000 Weeks, where he uses the average number of weeks that humans live, 4,000, as a reference point to help us examine how we are living, especially in a world of impossible demands and infinite choice and countless productivity techniques that mainly just leave us feeling busier and likely less fulfilled. Oliver's perspective and insights were a breath of fresh air for me, and I hope you'll leave this conversation inspired to do the internal work to get clear on your values and your first principles and to prioritize your time based on things that really matter to you so that ultimately you too can make the most of the remaining weeks that you have in your life. And with that, let's jump right into this week's conversation with Oliver Berkman. Oliver, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Stoked to have you here. Your practicality in the way that you wrestle with ideas, I love it. You're really clear on fluff isn't going to make it. Overhyped positivity isn't going to make it. And I want to kind of drill into the weight of where that came from. I think that there's going to be a crossover between respect for the newspaper, but then also your dad's influence on timelines and deadlines and management. And like, can you help me understand that crossover a bit?
Yeah, I write about this in the book. I think he's largely flattered to be in the book as opposed to insulted to be lightly teased in the book. But I mean, I certainly owe my father and my mother for that sense that like newspapers matter and writing matters and being able to communicate what's going on in the world or inside your mind accurately is a thing you can give to the world. I also in the book talk about coming from a family of sort of compulsive planners, people who are pretty keen on getting all their plans lined up far in advance, and how to some extent that's sort of what I'm pushing back against in my sort of explorations of time and time management these days, that there isn't it's very easy to overinvest in that feeling that you want to be in control of your unfolding time in ways that make you miserable and that in fact are antithetical to like high performance and doing things and accomplishing things, right? You can go too far in that direction. So, you know, this is the tale as old as time. I owe an enormous amount to my parents and spend my professional career in reaction against them. You know, it's both those things. I hope that the result is kind of, it's something that that resonates with people. But yeah, I mean, is that what you're after with that question? I'm not too sure. Right.
Yeah, no, there it is. Like how that influence happened and then your response to that influence. And it doesn't sound like, I don't want to do too much on the psychodramatic stuff here, but it doesn't sound like you're like had this radical rebellion, but you're like, no, I know that I'm pushing up against the ethos of the family or this particular lane of the ethos. And, you know, it's like, I'm not going to do it the way they did it. So I'm going to carve a new path and I'm going to have high regard and respect for, you know, the family.
Well, and what your question makes me remember as well is that in a sense, I think all books, at least in this genre, all kinds of writing that exist in this kind of broadly advice, prescriptive nonfiction, as they call it in publishing. All of that is always some kind of act of self-therapy, right? You're writing, I'm writing, for example, about my perspective on time, not because I've figured it all out and now I get to share it with you kind of lucky mortals. It's that the writing of the book is the exercise in figuring it out. So you're sort of writing the book that you need to have existing in the world. And I think that's always, for pretty much everybody, going to involve, to some extent, coming to terms with the bits of their sort of family inheritance that they want to sort of reframe or move away from or something like that. So certainly, you know, I do not come from a background of super laid back, chilled out people who can go with the flow and adapt easily to events. They have so many wonderful strengths and I love them to bits, but that I would say isn't necessarily one of them. And, you know, that's an incredibly useful skill for someone to develop. I think in these times, it's more useful than it's ever been to be able to sort of respond in that more flexible way. And it's one of the letting go of control a bit and sort of being more at ease with not knowing about what's coming is one of my particular challenges in life. We all have some, and you know, the act of writing is to explore that and to come to terms with it. And then you realize once you put the writing out there that there's like lots of people who seem to think you were inside their heads with a monitoring chip or something, because they're like, that's exactly how I always think about it. So yeah.
Yeah. That, okay. So I want to pull on the psychology of that for just a moment, but I think it'd be cool if we could level set. There's so much that we could talk about, really. Like your first book, the title alone speaks volumes, which is Happiness for People Who Can't Stand Positive Thinking. And before we dive deep into the content, if you just gave a headline of what you hope, maybe one or two or three things that people would be able to pull from this conversation, what would you hope happens?
Well, firstly, I'd like to convey my sense, which I sometimes think of almost like a sort of overarching philosophy here, that there are all sorts of ways in which we try too hard to be happy, to be in control, to know what the future is bringing, and that it's actually an incredible relief to realize that that is basically an impossible quest, and to give up trying to do things which are completely impossible for finite humans to do. Not just a relief, but actually the precondition for then accomplishing the greatest things of which you're capable. Putting it that way makes it sound like I want to sort of deliver a message in this conversation. I really find in my interactions with people, readers, all the rest, that actually one of the most powerful things here is just the sort of, there's something incredibly empowering about understanding the ways in which we're all in the same boat. And there's that sort of moment when someone says in response to something maybe I've written, oh yes, yeah, it's like that. Like you get that moment where you're like, oh yeah, this is what it feels like to be a human being. Not because I delivered this stunning new information into their brains, but because there's something powerful in just sort of seeing what you've kind of always known. So I don't know if that's too vague for what you're asking here, but I would love to feel that people listening to this conversation had some sense of that, as well as sort of, you know, hearing my message and finding it useful in their lives.
Yeah, so there's a deeper, the way that I push it through a couple filters is that what I hope is that people see themselves and know that they're not alone. Mm. That we're more similar than dissimilar. And what I'm on about, I think a lot of people are on about. And right. So we're in it together.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah. I think absolutely. That is one of the themes that I find cropping up in all sorts of things that I write or that I'm interested in, people who sort of energize me to talk with. And it is empowering in itself, right? I mean, to understand that, to put less effort into maintaining the facade of being different from other people or being, you know, it's so liberating to sort of be able to talk honestly about the way it actually is. And again, not so that you can spend the rest of your life like in despair or lying in a hammock doing nothing, but precisely so that we can sort of get down to business on the things that really matter with as much energy and focus as possible.
Can you talk about this political correctness? Because you've got a, which I love, the counterculture to the zeitgeist is kind of how you position. I think much of your insight is counterculture, which I love it. So I would love to hear your take on that.
One of the ways in which what gets called political correctness sort of dominates our sort of public conversations at the moment is that there's a lot of focus, and I think it's a perfectly legitimate focus, on the ways in which different groups of people have different amounts of power in society. And that is sort of the one topic that is the sort of topic of conversation in politics and culture. And I don't, and I'm absolutely will stand up for people having that conversation. But what that tends to do, I think, is to neglect these kind of universal, timeless sufferings that just come from being human, not come from your position in society or how you've been treated, but just from the fact that we find ourselves in this ridiculous situation as human beings, finite lifetime, the capacity to conceive of, you know, infinite plans, ambitions, goals, whatever, and having to manage that that kind of mismatch. So a lot of the time, you know, one little example of this would be that, you know, imposter syndrome, it's a big deal. Everyone always talks about it. One standard way to respond to that, someone saying that they feel like they're not good enough or that they don't know what they're doing, is to really try to boost their ego and say like, no, you have as much right to be here as anybody else. You know what you're doing. You're really good at it. I always feel like actually a more powerful way to address that is to sort of point at the ways in which, quite correct, that none of us know what we're doing at any moment, that everyone is winging it in some sense, that we are all in this together. So I think, you know, in everything from hyperpolarized, you know, political institutions, some of the manifestations of identity politics, all these things, they do have this effect of separating people off into camps. And I'm really trying to say, like, firstly, there is a sense in which we're all in the same camp. And then secondly, it's kind of a downbeat truth, I guess. I hope it's funny, and I do find it very amusing sometimes to sort of explore these ideas, but it's not about how everyone's great. It's how we're all in some way a bit kind of flawed and rubbish, and we're all just sort of stumbling through, not knowing what the future holds. And I know that Americans quite rightly hear something British in that outlook, but I think it's also true. Like, I think there's something very liberating about sort of acknowledging that we're all just in a huge mess, and then we can just start making the best of it and picking up a few of the pieces instead of trying desperately to convince ourselves that we're not in a huge mess.
I'd love it. You know, when people talk to me about that bit, you know, the imposter syndrome, my response is like, it's pretty consistent, which is, oh, good. Welcome.
Yes, right. Yes,
yeah, good.
Yes.
Okay, good. You know, like, yeah, all right. And then this idea, this kind of undergirth philosophy for me is quite evident. And you can probably pick apart the tradition that I borrowed it from, but we're all going through something.
Right.
Right. And so there's, you know, that idea that suffering is part of the human experience. Mm-hmm. And I just put a little bit of a modern twist like on it, like we're all going through something. So like,
yeah.
Why are you pretending? Yeah, no. Why are you pretending that you're not? Like, that's the bigger question. And I think that's why the title of your first book was like, I loved it. You know, happiness for people who can't stand positive thinking and help. Yeah. So before we get into the 4,000 week philosophy, when I say you write self-help books, what do you do with that?
Explode in rage and storm off the podcast. No, not at all. I'm completely reconciled. Should we use that word to this label?
I haven't yet. It makes me gag because I'm writing right now. So that's why I'm asking you this question.
Here's how to reconcile yourself.
Okay, good.
You may know this, but you might not have made the connection to self-help. That it never used to be the case. Go back to the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans. It was not the case that philosophy and thinking was something that you did separate from the world of therapy in the broadest sense of helping yourself, of helping other people. The point of what ancient Greek and Roman philosophers were doing, the Stoics make it very obvious, especially now that everyone's rediscovered them, but it's true in lots of other traditions as well. The point was to find better ways to live or to reduce suffering. And as I'm sure you know, Buddhism, the founding texts of one of the major world religions, it's like lists of like tips and processes to go through to feel better. Like, it's totally self-help. And so, you know, I think something very strange happened when philosophy became sort of professionalized and moved fully inside the academy. And then what's left as self-help is this kind of rather dubious sector of people making wild claims. But there is nothing wrong with wanting to help yourself. And there's nothing wrong with wanting to share with other people your thoughts on how they might help themselves. There's something wrong with bad self-help, but there's something wrong with bad everything, right? So, you know, that's how to reconcile yourself to it.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, with chains slopping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's hydro.com, HYDROW.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you go check them out. So let's dive in to the philosophy about 4,000 weeks. Can you just kind of kick us down the path of like, I understand why that's important to you, but the tension that you felt to get you to writing this book?
Yeah. Well, my experience was for many years, I wrote a column for the weekend magazine of the Guardian newspaper about these kinds of issues, self-help, productivity, personal development, all the rest of it. And one of the things you get to do in that role, I suppose, is to try out huge numbers of like ways of organizing your tasks and your calendar and your life and the rest of it. And so that I basically what happened is sometimes the way I put it is like I tried enough of those things to realize that the magic method that was going to make everything all right forever was not to be found, right? Because you get to exhaust that path in a useful way. So I was kind of, this book is sort of what happened on the other side of that. I took the time to sort of think about why I was so fixated on trying to feel in control of my time or get on top of things, and how universal this feeling seemed to be, and how the way in which we approach doing that, especially in a lot of sort of mainstream productivity and time management advice, is just systematically impossible, right? It's an attempt by finite creatures to become so efficient and so optimized that they can do an infinite amount. And I sort of went pretty deep into that, both in my own life and introspection, but then also in reading and writing about it. I guess the idea that I'm trying to get at in the book is that we put a huge amount of effort into a kind of emotional avoidance, right? We think what we want to do, we may tell ourselves that what we want to do is live accomplished lives and do meaningful things and help people. But a lot of the time, what we want to do is kind of not feel the anxiety and stress that comes from acknowledging our limits and our finite nature. So I think one way to understand a lot of the appeal of productivity advice is people don't want to confront that fact that, like, they're going to have to choose which things they're going to do and which things they're going to let slide. They want to find a way that makes them so efficient that they never have to make tough choices about them. Or you find in some corners of self-help these approaches to prioritization that are not really about prioritization at all. They're about sneakily finding a way to do everything and not have to make any tough choices, right? It's not about actually facing up to that fact that, like, being finite involves choosing among things. Same with trying to control and plan for the future, we were talking about before. That, again, is an attempt to sort of get into the driver's seat in a way that I don't think it's possible for a human just finding themselves in human life to do. And so we put all sorts of effort into drawing up new schemes for planning our lives and setting goals, because it helps us not feel the truth, which is like, you're here, this is it, life isn't a dress rehearsal, you don't have that much time, and you don't have much control over the time that you do have. So I guess I'm trying to sort of lead people through that understanding.
Say that again. Say that again. Those three or four steps. Yeah, those are really... And the reason I'm asking to say it again is because I find the concept to be deep and your writing to be practical, pragmatic. And so there's a really cool tension between the two that you struck. And so what you just said is really rich.
There is something very liberating and empowering in seeing that there will always be too much to do, that you will always miss out on most things that the world has to offer if you're going to spend time doing any of them. We want to sort of feel like we're controlling the future, but we actually can't. And if you can, it never comes out the same way twice.
No, you're on it. Yeah, same theme.
The basic idea here is that there is something, it's good to face up to these truths. There's something in the culture and in maybe just in human life in general that wants to deny that wants to say, I'm going to find a way to do everything. I'm going to find a way to feel certain about what's coming down the pike. And all the effort that we invest in that, number one, makes things worse for various reasons that we can discuss if you like. And number two, just takes away energy and focus from actually doing and accomplishing a few important things with your short time on Earth. So my trick, as I see it, maybe other people won't agree, is always to try to help people to see this insight by kind of saying the situation is even worse than you think, right? So it's like it's this kind of negative route to a positive endpoint. It's a matter of saying, like, you think that getting through everything on your to-do list is really hard and is going to take tons of time and tons of effort. Well, no, it's worse than that. It's actually impossible to get through everything on your to-do list. You think that you have to spend hours every week strategizing and reading books about the future and dealing with, you know, concocting systems of plans and goals in order to be confident about the future. But no, it's worse than that. Even if you do all of that, you still won't know what's happening in the future. So there's a very useful move. Doesn't mean that you should never make plans or think about the future, by the way. But there's a very useful move, which is like, oh, I've been trying to do something in my life that I thought was really difficult, but it's actually as impossible as making 2 + 2 add up to 5. And when you go through that understanding, what you come out on the other side as is like, oh, great. Well, now a burden is lifted from me and I can dive in to these things I really want to do without the distraction of trying to do everything.
So in some respects, what I hear you saying is you need to make a choice. And the idea of trying to collect as many birds in the hand as you can is a bit futile. Like,
yeah, or as you
hold one or two well.
Right, right. Or as your former guest, Mark Manson, would say, not only that you have to choose, but that you're always choosing anyway. You're just doing it unconsciously. Because you're finite and the opportunities and tasks and emails are infinite, you're always choosing effectively not to do huge numbers of things. It's just that you're doing it unconsciously in a way that then tends to leave you at the whim of other people's agendas or doing whatever seems easiest in the moment or something like that. So the move here is really from unconsciously choosing to consciously choosing. And that requires you to face up to the fact that these are choices, that there isn't a magic way to sort of evade the terms and conditions of being human. Yeah.
And the forcing function that you're using is saying, listen, you've only got on average 4,000 weeks. And, you know, it's borrowed from the math of 1440, right? There's 1,440 minutes a day. What are you going to do with them? 980, yeah. You're sleeping. So like, what are you doing with your time?
It is. Can I jump in there? I mean, one of the things that makes me want to say is, like, you're absolutely right. There is then an interpretation that people sometimes put on this, which is, okay, time is short. I got to seize the day. I've got to make sure that I spend every day doing only astonishingly remarkable things. I've got to, like, you know, go base jumping every weekend. I don't know. I've got to live this kind of very effortful seizing the day kind of life. And that may be what some people truly want to do. But I think that's a bit of a misunderstanding of what I'm saying if people go down that road, because there's something much calmer, I think, about the message that I'm trying to get across here. It isn't that because time is short, you've got to, like, absolutely cram it with amazing experiences so that you can still end your life feeling like you're kind of like you reached sort of God level at being a human. In fact, it's just that it's okay to come back down to the level and the scale of a human life and to live wholeheartedly in a human way and in a really full human way, instead of constantly trying to sort of break the limitations of your situation. And by the way, I think that is completely consistent with doing incredible accomplishments in your life, in your career. I don't think those are at odds at all, but it's about sort of not fighting the reality that you're in. And I think the person who tells themselves they've got to do, you know, dangerous sports every weekend and they've got to live at this kind of high octane level all the time, they are still trying to refuse to feel the situation they're in a little bit.
And are you, let's put the lens of mastery on top of your thinking or infused in your thinking. I think what I hear you saying is pick a couple things, choose well, and then really spend your time watering or hydrating, nursing, whatever the metaphor is, those elements of your life. And as opposed to spreading thin across the crust, saying yes and no to, you know, or trying to say yes to everything and saying no to depth. So am I hearing that right? Which is,
yeah,
a few deep as opposed to many wide.
I think you do hear it right. I think one thing I'd add to it is, if you're like me, that kind of advice can sometimes spark an anxiety. It's like, but I can't give up D, E, F, G, H, and I just to focus on A, B, and C. And there again, I would just say that telling yourself that you're choosing now your two or three deep things and you're never going to make another change in the whole of your life, that's just the same thing I've been talking about, right? That's just still trying to sort of, yeah, project on out over your whole life. So I think it's useful to say, like, yes, go deep, but, like, you can change, you can course correct. There's an anxiety, isn't there, in letting things go undone, that it's actually very useful to be able to tolerate. So, like, if you can if you've got like 10 amazing things you want to do with your business, say, like there's a real skill in being able to pursue two of them and accept that the other eight are on the back burner for now. Like that high achieving driven people don't like doing that. They want to feel like they have they're moving forward on every front. And it's actually a real inner psychological skill to be able to say, okay, I feel that anxiety, but this is the right way to make the most progress. By the way, it probably is, I think, I don't know what you'd say, the best way to get through a larger number of those 10 things anyway, to work on them sequentially. And it's the same with like, you know, can I turn on my computer in the morning and work on some piece of writing that I'm invested in for 2 or 3 hours, knowing that there are emails in the inbox, you know, rather than telling myself I'm going to get rid of all the emails in the inbox before I turn to the writing.
Okay, so I'm tracking with all of this, and I'll share like just a little business anecdote. Early on in my career, somebody said to me, an entrepreneur I really respected, quote unquote, in my you know, viewpoint, like he did it well and he did it the right way. So he did well doing good. And he said, Mike, it's early days. It's like riding a bunch of horses. A couple of them are going to feel like stallions. So stay connected to those, but you have to ride a lot of horses early on. And in other words, he was saying, stay wide until you can know. And then, but your job is to know. And then once you feel, and it's like an internal experience, once you feel that this is a stallion, it doesn't mean that this is going to make you a lot of money, but it's like, this is going to be a good ride. There's something really powerful here that's grabbing my attention.
Yeah.
Grab onto those stallions, but hold your hands around a couple other, because you're still young. You don't know, you know, like stay honest, keep taking inventory about how this feels. And then he says, and then at some point you'll know. And then as time has passed, in the sophisticated language of business, I've got 5 initiatives that were kind of always working and I can't stay attuned to all 5. That's why we have a full team. Mm-hmm. And so my craving is to get through emails. My discipline is to be able to carve out enough time to go deep and to think and to feel. And so that's why I'm asking about that deep versus wide scenario. And I'm wondering if you put any thought on kind of the origins of this fear that is taking place of wanting to touch many and to go wide. Is it more fear of missing out? Is it more of a fear of what people might think of you? How do you grok with the fear that sits underneath this pervasive need to do much?
I mean, there are multiple answers, and my cast of mind always wants to go back to like the most ultimate, the most sort of it's the human condition type of thing. So firstly, to touch that point, I would say the acknowledgement that you can't do everything and that you can't do many, many things effectively, and that you need to put some things on the back burner so that you can pour your energy into others. Like that is a confrontation with limitation. If you could be present everywhere at once and you had an unlimited time, if you were God, you know, these issues wouldn't arise. So it's a confrontation with limitation, and ultimately it's a reminder that you're going to die. And that's the organizing thing that we're keen to not have to confront. I do think that then on top of that, there are all these other forces that really encourage that, right? So it really feels in the way the modern economy is organized, especially if you're self-employed or independent small business person, but applies to other people too, that you've got to be able to do more than anyone else can do just in order to, you know, keep your head above water. It feels like that's going to be the path to being sustainable in a sort of cutthroat environment. I think it isn't. I think increasingly patience and the ability to focus on a few things at once is a huge competitive advantage, as well as better for long-term meaningfulness. So I think there's lots of different reasons why we are naturally predisposed towards doing more, feeling like we are on top of everything, feeling like if there's something we could be doing or ought to be doing, we're in there. We've got our finger in that pie, you know? And I think it's all an attempt to try to feel that we're not finite in the ways that we in fact are. So it's out of step with reality and it doesn't lead to the best results. But anyway, go on. Yeah.
No, I mean, the thinking is rich, you know, so I'm appreciating it. People often ask me, like, you know, what are the common threads for World's Best? And what doesn't get talked about enough is patience. It takes time. Mm-hmm. It takes time to hydrate properly. You know, the essence of what it takes to really understand how to artistically express it. Anything, mm-hmm. whether it's mm-hmm. movement or ideas. And the patience is, there's like a crosshairs between patience and unreasonableness. And there's an unreasonableness that comes with many of the best, which is, no, it needs to be better now. Mm. At the same time, this holding, this container, like, we got to put in our work.
Yeah.
And it takes time. So that it's an interesting tension. It almost sounds like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, or each philosophy is competing with one another. But can you unpack those two? Because I don't have a better, I run out of language to try to articulate those two tensions, right? Which is the high effort, the deep intensity, mm-hmm. the unreasonableness to think that they can be their very best, which might just be the best in the world. And at the same time, I understand it takes time. And it is a superpower in many respects, this the valuing of patience.
Yeah, that's a fascinating way of talking about it, because you're absolutely right. I mean, I go on at length in the book about the benefits of patience, but you're absolutely right that there's a flip side. I suppose where they come together for me is in this, see if I can unpack this, but like in this idea of active patience, right? When I talk about the benefits of patience, I'm not talking about the benefits of being able to just wait. That can have its role. But I was really influenced writing the book by the work of an art historian at Harvard called Jennifer Roberts, who has her students do something that I did for the book as well, which is to choose a painting and go and look at it for 3 hours straight without a break. And her argument is that you literally see things in a painting. I'm not talking figuratively here. You literally see things in a painting after looking at it for an hour that you had missed for the first hour. And if you're interested in art, it's a fascinating experience. But there's also this broader point that, you know, we're accustomed to thinking about patience as something that you know, you say it to the four-year-old who really wants to go and do something now. And it's just like, deal with the fact that you don't have any control in the situation. Find a way to just live with the fact that it's another half hour till we're going to the amusement park or whatever. But as Jennifer Roberts points out, as our society has accelerated, and as we live now in a culture that is geared for rush and hurry, to be able to be patient is actually a kind of control. It's a way of exerting influence over a situation. To be able to give certain things the time that they really just do take, whether that is appreciating a work of art, creating a work of art, or any of the many moving parts of any kind of business. In that case, I'm trying to bring these two things together that you rightly note our intention and say, you know, it may be that the fastest way, it may be that you need results fast, but it also may be that the fastest way to that result is patience on a moment to moment, day to day level. In other words, go as fast as you need to go, go as fast as the process allows, but don't go faster because you're just giving in to this inner emotional tension that says, like, I need the world to go much faster than it's going. If you can act independently of that kind of inner anxiety, you will sometimes move fast and you will sometimes give things the time they take. But the end result, I'm convinced, will be to get to better results faster anyway, right? In the example that I gave, if your goal is to write a really perceptive paper about the work of a given artist, like if you just go and look at all their paintings for 5 minutes and then try and write it and realize you don't have anything to say, so you have to go back to their paintings, like you'll end up writing that paper slower than the person who just sat for 3 hours in front of the painting. So patience in that case is a way of getting to the goal faster. Now, how or whether that analogizes to the other contexts you were talking about, I don't know.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be a bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTrue.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. You know, as you say that, the crossover is deep focus. And so the unreasonable nature, what they're saying is, no, we need to focus more. We need to be all in. We need to commit. We need to believe. We need to high effort with deep focus. Right. And then what you just described in patience is, no, have the discipline to spend time focusing. Mm-hmm. And your mind wants to jump to this, that, the other, answer emails, answer the phone, think about something else. No, return back to this present task.
yeah,
and have the patience. Yeah. And I actually hear, instead of patience, I hear like the discipline to be focused on the one or two things, like in particularly the one thing. And as you're talking about the time nature, our producer was an elite athlete in college. He was a kicker at one of the big football universities, USC. And one of his coaches shared with him, and he shares it with us, is that take the time it takes so it takes less time.
Perfect. That's all I spent the last 10 minutes trying to say. That's brilliant. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, fantastic. I'm going to have that tattooed on my wrist or something.
Yeah. Oh, God. Okay. All right. So let's slightly shift gears to what you're suggesting is a radical idea, because the world and our brains in many respect is designed for surface engagement. Mm-hmm. Multitasking is a thing we had to actually square up and find that from a neuroscience perspective, that it's really inefficient and actually is quite unhealthy. So what you're asking or calling for, ringing the bell on, is quite radical. And what I found is to make changes, either you need to kind of really be off access from your community and your social mm-hmm. group, or your social group, you have enough people in your immediate circle that go, that you can populate the idea and they go, yeah, I'm in. So then it becomes a bit easier to be able to have that community of people that are reinforcing a first principle. So what you're suggesting are first principles that are radical. And mm-hmm. How did you do it? And how do you recommend other people do it? And maybe I need to put a little sharper handle on this. What is the first principle? The first principle is have the discipline to focus on few and to go deep with that. Take your time and be patient. This is not about work-life balance. This is about being fully present with what matters most to you. Mm-hmm. And how do you get the community or have the N of one, you know, in science, it's like just the one individual, the subject of one, to be able to make that move. So I'm now asking something very practical.
Yeah. And this is, I mean, I have some thoughts, but it's also like the big question. I think it's so fascinating. And I've been sort of looking into it further recently since the book was out, this question of what do you do with an insight, right? If I say I succeed in this book, in sort of rewiring your understanding of time a little bit, like what do you do with that? And there are a whole bunch of sort of specific techniques that I outline in the book and at the end of the book, but it's the bigger question than that. It's like, you know, how do you cross that gap from knowing to doing? And you're absolutely, I mean, you know this, but I think you're completely right that peer influence and accountability, certainly in my life, with anything from like fitness to coaching, meditation, all the rest, like it's just, there's just no comparison if somebody is involved in it with you or is waiting for your results that week or something like that. For people who aren't in a position to do that or feel like they're not in a position to do that or just feel like they're totally going against the grain, I do think it's this can be approached incrementally. It really can. And what you learn if you sort of try to lean into this way of being a bit more is two things. It feels uncomfortable, and then you get almost instantaneous feedback that discomfort is fine. Like, it's not going to kill you. If you go into the sort of, some of the writers who've looked at the sort of, in the psychotherapeutic vein of this, there's a writer called Bruce Tift, whose work I really, really admire. And he points out that like, on some unconscious level, the reason that you find it, that one person finds it difficult to let go of something, to stop doing something, to focus, to disappoint someone in order to focus on something more, you know, there's some concern there that you're going to feel a feeling and that feeling would somehow destroy you, right? That it would be so intolerable to feel that you'd let your parents down or to feel that you hadn't kept on top of all the things you think a good person would keep on top of. And so it's incredibly useful to expose yourself to little bits of that feeling and to realize, guess what? They don't actually destroy you. They don't annihilate you. The
you talk about your parents or the feelings?
the parents don't annihilate you, but even the feelings don't annihilate you. Right, exactly. Yeah, and so the patience thing is such a good example of this, because if you're prone to like getting impatient in traffic jams or something, like it really feels in that moment like to just take a breath and just be with the fact that that the traffic's not moving would be, it feels unthinkable. Now, in a very small number of cases, if there's like, you know, a woman going into labor in the backseat of your car or something, it really is bad that you can't make the traffic go as fast as you need it to go. But most of the time, that's just this kind of slightly petulant need to have the world go as fast as you think you need it to go. And to let that stop, and this obviously applies in lots of more interesting cases than traffic jams, the discomfort that arises is fine. You get used to it. You even get a taste for it, because you get sort of, you develop this kind of taste for doing the difficult thing in a slightly, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. I don't know how you quite put it into words, but that sort of nourishing or juicy sense that like you're kind of building a cool new skill, which is the skill not to just give in to hurry, give in to the desire to have every email in your inbox squared away. There's something in that resistance, which is kind of like feels good.
I love the word nourishing, you know, that feels real, that, you know, I used the word hydration earlier. There's something super organic about what takes place when you are met with a challenge and you're working through it.
Yeah.
And that is how elite athletes and elite performers organize their life. Every day they train capabilities, physical, technical, and mental capabilities. And then they organize some sort of activity to test those capabilities. Mm-hmm. Then they've got coaches as a feedback loop in a community that report back to them saying, hey, let's look at the film. Did you feel that? Did you see that? How can we get this better? I think that can get better. And then you go back the next day and you develop physical, technical, mental capabilities, and you test them. Mm-hmm. And that is like, it's not complicated, but where do we find that in business? Where do we find that in our daily life? And this is where the structure of, let's call it world religions, have been so valuable, but have fallen apart,
yeah,
you know, in many respects. So like, where do we get that if we don't cultivate it in our own smaller communities as well?
I'm interested to ask you, or I can talk about it too, but whether you think in this context about the word and the concept of craft, because I do think that there's something very powerful in the notion. It's very easy to see in the context of sort of a material craftsperson, someone who, you know, a carpenter or somebody who sculpts things out of clay or something. But I think it's present as well in the kind of work that all we people doing like concepts and keyboard toting, whatever it is that we do in virtual space, you know, it applies as well. This it's hard to express, but for me, and I'll get out of the way because I'm interested in your thoughts, but for me, it's something to do with the idea that there is an encounter when a craftsman works on a piece of stone, you know, there is an encounter between the physical limitations of the world and their skills. There is no sense that you're going to sort of become sort of overmaster the whole thing. There is no sense that it can all be done in a moment. Patience is absolutely essential. And yet dedicated work and honing of skills is absolutely essential. It's not grunt work. You can't make it algorithmic and just do it. There is this kind of moment to moment encounter between you and the material limits of the world. That is for me always embodied in this idea of that what we're doing is craft, maybe as opposed to art or science or something. I don't know. So I'm interested. That word sort of encapsulates a lot of this for me.
This is two parts to it. One is, on record saying this a lot, you know, which is that there's only three things humans can train. They can train their craft, they can train their body, and they can train their mind. Mm. And so the word craft matters a lot to me. And I think the craft that where it gets a little bit more complicated is when it's not physical, like stone or canvas with paint, what is the craft that you are wrestling with? And I can answer for me, my craft is it's invisible. Mm-hmm. And which makes it, in some respects, harder because the feedback of the invisible world is difficult.
Yeah.
And like it's this porous connection between an idea and being able to take ideas and then hopefully they're stemming from some insight / maybe even a deep wisdom and then putting those into words. And sometimes mm-hmm. those words come out in physical form, meaning through body language.
Yep.
And sometimes they come out in written form, like the book you've written. So that is the craft, is working with ideas and being able to express ideas and or working with people to help them express their ideas. And the subtexture of that craft is the relationship between thoughts and emotions and the relationship between thoughts, emotions, and the unfolding environment.
Yeah.
And so it's, I love this science and I love this craft because I find it to be rich and deep and fertile and complicated. And the world of the invisible is fascinating. And it feels in some respects overwhelmingly full of imagination. Yeah. And imagination can be provoke high anxiety. I find it trying to, you know, think about what word, and you recognize like, what word am I going to choose? What phrase is going to, if I'm sloppy, what four phrases are going to capture this idea, you know, let alone 40 pages, right? So,
Go on.
No. I think craft is a beautiful way to think about a worthwhile cause and to say, what is your craft? And that's for all of us.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting because it's so hard it's so easy in the virtual world and the world of virtual feedback and virtual or invisible also craft as you put it, it's very easy to end up in the sort of hamster wheel pursuit that goes beyond one's limitations, right? To seek a sort of crazy perfectionism. One assume, for example, you ought to do more than you possibly can do in the time available. I assume that it occurs less frequently to somebody who is cultivating vegetables for a living that they ought to be able to cultivate an infinite number of vegetables. Like that is not going to occur to you. You can feel and see the limitations. The notion that I ought to be able to cope with any number of emails that come into my inbox is actually a very popular one in our society. Or the idea that if you write something or you're giving a talk or something, you somehow ought to be able to make it perfect in a way that will completely torment you forever as you try to make it more and more perfect and never get there. In a way, again, that I assume that I have never built a house with my bare hands, but I assume that if you do that, on some level, you acknowledge and accept and understand that there are imperfections all the way through a structure like that. I mean, I'm sure people are different, but it's very easy to go off on down these rabbit holes of chasing the transcendence of your limitations in a way that I think is unhelpful. So yeah, I'm always struggling with that.
So we would not argue about the time it takes to build something, you know, like we might be unreasonable to say I want a house built in X number of months when it really, to do it beautifully well would be 18 months, let's say, or whatever the numbers are, I don't know.
Yep.
But we wouldn't argue that for, it's like almost blasphemy to say, we need these peppers to grow faster,
right.
And at the same time, I would say this, it is also true for relationships, your relationship with yourself and your relationship with others, that it takes time. And, you know, nurturing that time there's the patience. And no wonder 50% of marriages like end, you know, we're trying to answer emails rather than kind of answer like deeper needs. And so, on that note, I find that, you know, once you're done with the book, it's kind of like, what did I write? You know, but do you have any stories either in the writing process that you're like, oh, this was so wild or fun or meaningful or stupid or whatever it might be, like stories that happened while you're writing and or stories that you uncovered and shared in the book that you're like happy or would love to share?
Let me think. I mean, most of the insights that I gained during the writing process will feel very down to earth and not sort of amazing stories if I tell them, because it was very much that kind of process of incrementally figuring out what the book was, and sort of I feel like I had to change my personality a bit to be able to even complete the book. And there was a moment when the COVID lockdowns came, and I didn't begin the book then. I'd been doing it for far too long, really, but that really helped me finish it, ironically. Not because I had a great insight about life from the pandemic, but just because for a couple of weeks I was terrified that the world publishing industry was going to collapse, and I wanted my delivery payments before all the publishers around the world had collapsed. So this was an interesting education to me, because I try not to say to people that you should be motivated by fear, but for a couple of weeks there I was, and it did get me over some kind of hump. And after that, when it was very clear that actually book publishing was going to do very well from the tumult of the last 2 or 3 years, by then I was just on course, and I was going, and I was motoring again, and I'd got over this sort of blockage. But I always feel a bit bad telling that story, because I feel like the lesson there is scare yourself into productivity, and that kind of goes against quite a lot of what I feel I believe. But it happened. So there's that.
You're hitting on something that is mechanically important, which is there's acute stress, like, you know, alarm bell goes off, someone kind of breaks through your front door. There's the acute stressors. And then there's moderate stress, which is, you know, between, let's call it up to 6 weeks, somewhere in that range.
Right.
And that moderate stress actually we can do some of our best work during that. Mm. It's not sustainable. We fall into the chronic stress pretty quickly, but like, we can do some of our best work with that heightened intensity. And I hear you saying, like, I don't want to promote that. But if you have strategies to recognize, like, okay, I see the phase I'm in, and I am going to be disciplined for this X number of kind of high intensity, maybe fear-induced higher productivity, then okay, then it's okay, as long as you can understand that I'm going to really take care of myself nightly, and I'm going to take care of myself at this end of this kind of 4 or 6 week.
That is the conceptual framework to approach it in, because I don't regret that for 3 or 4 weeks there I was in that heightened state.
Strike when the iron's hot. There's lots of phrases.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Yeah. But I'm glad that I didn't have to keep it up. The only other story I was going to mention, I write in the book about Shinzen Young, the meditation teacher, recounting his early training as a Buddhist monk that, long story short, involved living in a hut on a Japanese mountainside in winter and dousing himself with ice cold water from a bucket. His naked body with ice cold water from a bucket 3 times a day. We can talk about this is obviously now extremely fashionable, the cold exposure stuff, but but back then it was reserved for people on an ascetic path. And he makes this point that what you learn if you have the commitment to do that to yourself multiple times a day, and people who've done the sort of cold shower stuff will probably concur, is your first instinct is to try to not focus on what's happening to you and to think about other things, or to, you know, like, think about what you're gonna have for dinner, or just not be mentally present with the unpleasant sensation. But what you learn, as he explains very eloquently, is that the way to reduce the sense of suffering in the moment is to pay more attention to the sensations, to be more fully present with those sensations. And I'm sure this touches all sorts of things in your work. I've had a limited experience of that on meditation retreats, when one thing that happens on meditation retreats is your knees begin to absolutely kill you if you're me. And there is a very interesting moment when you get so focused on pain that it stops being painful, because I don't know why. I think one way of thinking about all this that is just useful, and it comes back to the deep focus point, is that in some sense, you have a limited attentional bandwidth and you need to have some of that spare in order to use it to suffer or to moan and whine about your situation. And the more completely focused it is on your actual situation, the less suffering there is, even if the situation is a bad one, even if the situation is characterized by pain. So if you can fill up your, if you can get better at being present, if you can do what Shinzen Young was doing and focus on how it really feels to have ice cold water hitting your skin on a cold mountainside in winter, you've actually got less brain space left over to be sort of railing against that and wishing things were otherwise. So I think that's an interesting way of thinking about attention.
You know, the response that I have to that is that when we do when we're in pain, like the discomfort pain that you're talking about, or the cold, that discomfort, is that it's the fighting it that is draining. It's the fighting it that creates extra tension in the process. But the noticing and the curiosity about, oh, look at my knees shake, or look at my hips shake, or look at my low back. That's interesting. My back, it's doing this. And oh, look how my mind, and oh, wow, now there's emotions and I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do this. And what are they going to think of me? And. And so it's that narrative that is so draining, that when you can actually just observe and be curious about it, instead of being critical and worrying about it, it fundamentally changes the experience. Not to mention, it's a little bit like this. I don't know if you've ever downhill skied.
Technically, yes. And in all other respects, no. I've tried skiing once, basically, in a down.
So it's a little bit, okay, so you'll relate to the early part of this, but yeah.
Everyone else on my slopes was about 7 years old or something. That was my level. Anyway, yeah, Karen.
Perfect. So when you start to pick up speed, it's really natural to want to kind of pull your body weight back, and which is the worst thing to do, because now you're out of control, right? And so if you allow your skis to do what they do, there's going to be speed. Now you can embrace that speed and even look for speed if you know that you have what it takes to adjust, to work with the speed. Right. And but that's the big part. Like, if you know you have what it takes for your knees to hurt just a little bit longer, no big deal. They're not going to rip off.
Yeah.
If you know you have what it takes to deal with this intense cold right now, no problem, you know? And so there's that framing, which you have to build that capability to say, I know I can figure this out.
Yeah.
I can deal with hard things. And then, you know, the idea that it's good and bad is actually quite problematic as well. It just versus, oh, this is interesting of it just is, what the actual experience is. Yeah. Okay. So I hear your Buddhist philosophy rolling in, you know, very cool. And then can you talk quickly, this is super mechanical now, about the two different to-do lists? And then I've got a bunch of kind of quick hit questions I'd like to ask you.
Sure. The two to-do lists idea is just a very simple way of implementing this idea of limiting your work in progress. The idea that it's very helpful to set a really strict limit on the number of items you sort of allow to have on your plate at any one time. People listening who are kind of totally into productivity techniques and stuff will be able to imagine more complicated implementations of this. But the really simple idea: keep two to-do lists. One of them is open. It's just everything goes on it that you could possibly need to do or have on your plate or thinking about doing. Maybe it's got 300 items on it, right? It's going to be insane. But you don't have to do that complete that to-do list in this approach. What you do is you keep a second list, a closed list that maybe has a fixed number of slots on it. Let's say 10 slots. And you feed items from the open list to the closed list. So you take like 10 things that need doing, and you put them onto those 10 slots. And then the rule is you can't move anything else onto the closed list until you've freed up a slot by completing one of those activities. Anyone familiar with Kanban will know that this philosophy is there too. Anyone familiar with GTD, getting things done, will immediately want to ask questions about whether this applies to projects or to tasks. And that's all good stuff. But the basic idea here is just create a deliberate bottleneck in your workflow so that there has to be a moment when you say, okay, here are 300 things I could in principle do, but here are the ones I'm going to do now, and I'm going to make the others wait until some of these are done. And I've just found this an incredibly, and other versions of it, an incredibly powerful way to sort of tolerate, hang out with that anxiety of like, should I be doing all this? It's like, no, you're saying to yourself, you're sort of taking yourself by the hand and treating yourself like a child in certain ways, but you're just, sometimes that's necessary. And you're just sort of saying, no, this is what we're going to be doing now. And let's just do that. And then we can bring more things on. And of course, the big discovery is that it's a quicker way of getting through more tasks anyway, to have that patience of not trying to do all of them at once. And, you know, if you're feeling really up for it, try five slots, try four slots, right? Try to sort of create a smaller and smaller bottleneck, and then just kind of move things through until they're done. It's very, very satisfying.
And I love that. Do you have it written at like a hard copy in front of you, or do you keep it on a digital list? Or does that not matter to you?
I'm always in transition with these things. And I think that's an important piece of wisdom too. Like I'm always like, it was a big moment for me when I realized that I wasn't going to get to a point when my productivity systems were fixed and final forever, that they're just going to be evolving, and that's fine. I think that's an important thing to remember. But, so basically I keep this all set up in a task management software called Things 3, which you probably know about. And then when it comes to the day, I then move it onto a little piece of card and keep it in front of me like that. So if I need to go back and get more tasks from the big lists, I will go back into Things 3 and move them onto the paper. But the idea is that a little index card should see me through a day rather than having to sort of go deep into the belly of my 1,000 task management system.
It's a well-tested system. You know, I can hear the software engineers in our community or the coders like, yeah, that's what we do. We pick up tickets. They've got a whole list of kind of parking lot tickets. I'm mixing metaphors. They've got a whole list of tickets that they can pull from, and then they just kind of grab the ones as they come up. Yeah, it's cool. Okay, so a couple quick hits. All right. Thought stems, and as a reductionist exercise here. Okay. It all comes down to
understanding that reality is not a problem you have to solve.
Cool. If I had,
I could ask, you had about 20 different answers to that stem. Yeah, so let's go.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. If I had a boat, the name of it would be.
Wow. I think I would try to be clever and cutesy, and I think I would call it the same boat, because that phrase about us all being in the same boat, I use about 12 times a day.
Wait, so the name is?
I think I call it the same boat.
The same boat.
I know that's an unacceptable kind of, maybe I should name it after my grandmother and call it Erica. I know that's what people do with boats. Go either way.
Okay, good. All right. If you were to come back again, if you could come back again and do it all over again, your craft would be?
I'd still write. I'm not a nice person to be around if I've spent more than a couple of weeks not doing any writing. It's too fundamental to who I am. I can't imagine being a person who doesn't want to do it. I mean, that said, the experience is often very irritating, but you know what I mean? In that higher sense of wanting to do it, I can fantasize about wanting to be a shepherd or a number of other things, but no, not really. Writer, sorry.
Yep, I gotcha. Procrastination is?
Unavoidable, semicolon. The important thing is to procrastinate on the right things.
If you knew what I knew.
These are vicious, man. You take my advice with a pinch of salt.
Listen, you had to pull the UK humor in at some point. Okay. I was waiting for it, Oliver. All right, good man. All right. So what would you name this episode?
What I name this episode?
This conversation. Yeah.
Oh gosh. I feel like the idea we're tracking is something to do with coming back down to the ground, with seeing that
reality is the place where things, good things happen, not in states of denial. There was an approach to therapy years ago, which got trademarked, and I have no idea if it's anything to do with what I'm talking about here, really, but which was called reality therapy.
Oh, yeah, Glasser. Yeah, Glasser.
Right. I don't know if it's connected at all, but I think that reality therapy is a little bit of, you probably don't want the word therapy anywhere near these conversations, but I do think that like reality therapy is a little bit what we're talking about here.
Yeah, you know, it's, I haven't had the conversation with somebody in a long time because it kind of had this moment, and I went to a seminar that he, like a workshop that he gave, and it was awesome. You know, like somebody would come up, it was like a masterclass in reality therapy, and he goes, he'd have somebody come up on stage, and it's a full auditorium, and he says, right, so what are you working on? And the person goes, kind of nervously, well, you know, this, and he goes, the reality, the nature of reality therapy is like, well, what are you doing about it? And the person's like, I'm talking to you. He goes, that's not going to do it. Like, what are you really doing about it? You know? And he goes, well, I don't really know. He goes, well, that's your point. You don't know. Like, you have to go. You, and, like, the reality is like, hey, go to work. That's the reality therapy. It was like, it was awesome. Oliver, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Not an entirely inside my comfort zone pleasure, but certainly a pleasure. So thank you.
So I hope that we find another way to spend some time, because your insights are rich and practical at the same time, which is a intersection that I really value. So thank you for the time, the insight, the contemplation that you expressed in looking to express what was honest and true for you. And it's a breath of fresh air. So I just want to say thank you. Where do you want to send our community to pick up your book and to follow along with your writings?
Well, the book 4,000 Weeks is wherever you get books and audiobooks, things like that. But on my website, oliverberkman.com has more about this and my newsletter and all the rest of it. Yeah.
Appreciate you.
Thank you very much indeed.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.